and welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Larry Kamer. The Deep Dive is an in-depth discussion on some of the most important issues facing Napa County and wine country. On our program, we try and present insights and stories that you might not hear anywhere else, the conversations that matter, the things people are talking about. We originate from the studios of KVON in Napa. Our new shows air every Thursday morning at 9, and you can always listen to past shows on our website at kvon.com. Always happy to hear from you, and especially welcome your suggestion for guests or topics that you'd like us to cover. If you'd like to come on the show and have something important to talk about, we'd love to hear from you. Email us at deepdiveshow@winedownmedia.com. On Twitter and Instagram at Deep Dive Show. And we'd appreciate it if you'd like us on our Facebook page, also Deep Dive Show. You can hear all of our past conversations on kvon.com. So last week, if you were listening, we had an in-depth conversation about everything from cannabis to wine to water to politics with Ryan Clovis, who's the head of the Farm Bureau, the Napa Farm Bureau, which is doing more and more work in the political area. Our very first show, we did a deep dive on the future of local news here in the Napa Valley and whether or not local news can survive in an era of fake news and tight economies. We followed that show with a discussion about the potential treasure that is Lake Berryessa and what's going to happen now that it is moving over to county management after 50 years of federal management, some would say mismanagement. And then last week, we had two people who are on the front lines of the homelessness issue here in Napa talking about the myths and realities of homelessness, what's being done, what's working, and what we can do as a community. But this week, we have a very sober topic. The week that we're recording this, the week of February 1st through the 8th, is National Gun Violence Survivors Week. And so on today's program, I want to pay respects, honor, and discuss how each of us can act for the victims of gun violence, especially in what we can do to educate ourselves and ultimately prevent future shootings. What makes this discussion really extraordinary is that every one of us in the studio, and there's four of us, and I'll introduce my guests in a second, we're all victims of gun violence. We're all survivors of gun violence. And that, to me, is just extraordinary, that you could find four people with different stories but with that same common theme. Now, by any standard, our community, the Napa Valley, has a very low rate of violent crime. It's about 2.75 per thousand for violent crime. Compare that to Vallejo, which is at 45 per thousand. Compare that to San Francisco, which is at 70 per thousand, one of the highest crime rates in America in an otherwise delightful place. But even though we are away from a lot of gun violence in this community, the reason we can't look away is that the incidents we're all familiar with have had shockingly wide impacts throughout the Napa Valley. Now, in about a month's time, we'll recognize the second anniversary of the deadly shooting at the Pathway Home in Yountville, which took the lives of Christine Lober, Jennifer Gray Golick, and Jennifer Gonzalez Shushariba, who was 26 weeks pregnant. The shooter, who was 36, also took his own life. In addition to those five deaths, this tragedy extended even wider to those who escaped the gunman, including the staff and the residents at the Pathway Home, to the first responders and their families, certainly throughout the California Veterans Home community in the town of Yountville, throughout the Napa Valley, and for a brief time, around the world. But as is often the case, that attention quickly moved on to the next mass shooting, which happened to be at a Waffle House in Nashville just a few weeks later, which killed four more people. And because I think it's always important to talk about these incidents by remembering the victims by name and not just so they become statistics. The victims in the Waffle House shooting were Tarian Sanderlin, who was 29, a cook at the restaurant who was on his cigarette break. De'Ebony Groves, 21, who was an honor student at Belmont University in Nashville. Aquila Da Silva, who was 23 and a Middle Tennessee State University student. And the youngest victim, 20, was a man named Joe Perez. So that year, in 2018, the U.S. experienced an average of one mass shooting per month. I read recently that in 2019, we had more mass shootings than we had days in the year. 2018 was also the year of the Borderline Bar and Grill shooting in Thousand Oaks, which took the lives of 12 people, including 18-year-old Elena Housley of Napa, who was a Vintage High graduate in her first year at Pepperdine. And just to remember, the victims of that shooting were Ron Helas, who was a 29-year veteran of the Ventura County Sheriff's Department, Sean Adler, 48, a security guard, Cody Kaufman, 22, who was on his way to the U.S. military, Blake Dingman, 21, from Newbury Park, and his friend Jake Dunham, also 21, Dan Manrique, 33, deployed to Afghanistan as a Marine Corps radio operator, returned to the States to work for a nonprofit serving veterans called Team Red, White, and Blue. Justin Meek, 23, who lost his life in that bar trying to save other people. Christina Morissette, who was a cashier there, she was 20. Telemachus Orfanos, who was 27, who had, ironically and sadly, lived through the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history, which was the Route 91 festival shooting in Las Vegas. And then finally, Noel Sparks, 21, who was an art student at Moorpark College. Police believe the gunman, who was also 28, took his life after attacking the Borderline Bar and Grill. I say all this because I think there are many ways to support those whose stories are similar to the ones my guests are going to talk about today. They are Liz Russell, 2020 Everytown Survivor Fellow and the Napa Valley Moms Demand Action Speak for Safety lead. Ilana Adelson, the co-lead of our local group here, Napa Valley Moms Demand Action. And Claire Senchina, who is the California co-lead of the Everytown Survivors Network. I want to welcome each of you to the program. Thanks for joining
Thanks.
Us.
Thank you.
So in prepping for the show, I explored what I can only call a treasure trove of information, which is the everytown.org website. That, you know, for those of us who think we know a little bit about guns and gun violence, there's more there than you can imagine. I counted for this organization, for Moms Demand, more than 40 meetings and activities just in the month of February alone. So I'm interested in learning more about Moms Demand. And I want to kind of frame our conversation by something that I found pretty compelling on that site, which was the way in which it's the most appropriate, the most impactful to honor gun violence survivors, which are on the site, share stories, educate yourself, start conversations, and take action. So I wonder if we could start just by kind of laying the groundwork. What's Everytown? What's Moms Demand? What are the other organizations that are involved in this complex of, you know, of groups?
So, yeah, sure. So Everytown for Gun Safety is the sort of umbrella or parent organization under which, falls Moms Demand Action, Students Demand Action, the Everytown Survivor Network, and is there one more I'm missing?
Mayors Against Illegal Guns.
And Mayors Against Illegal Guns. So those four organizations fall under Everytown for Gun Safety. And so here at Moms Demand Action, and for example, we're a grassroots organization with a chapter in every state. And then within those statewide chapters, there are then local groups. So our Napa Valley group here of Moms Demand Action is a local group within the state chapter of California of Moms Demand Action for Gun Safety in America. And I would say that in California, we have now surpassed, we have more than 30 local groups. So I'm not actually at all surprised to hear that, you know, you notice that in the month of February, there are at least 40 meetings taking place. And I would even argue that
a short month even.
Yes. And I would even say that there are probably certain kinds of actions that don't even necessarily get put on the calendar because there might be like planning meetings between, you know, leads and that sort of thing. So that's just to show you just how I think robust this movement is, how robust Moms Demand Action is, and just how much work is being done for gun violence prevention.
And Claire, you are involved at the statewide level in California. Tell me about the Everytown Survivor Network and the work that you're doing.
Well, if I may, I can tell you how I came across this group.
Please, yeah.
I live in San Francisco. I've lived there for about 35 years. I'm originally from the East Coast, and my son was born and raised there. And his goal was to join the San Francisco Fire Department. I worked as a nurse practitioner for many years at San Francisco General Hospital. So
God
he
love
was
you. That's God's work right there.
He was an EMT working for a company, Falk Ambulance, out of the South Bay, was going to paramedic school in San Jose, and Saturday night, December 6th, he came home from a full day of work. He had just completed paramedic school the day before, and we still lived in the same house, which was wonderful. He came home and said he was going to go out to celebrate. His birthday was coming up. He had finished a tough couple years of school, and he had a lot to celebrate. And he went to a neighborhood club, and on leaving, a stranger fired a gun, and one bullet hit him in the heart, and he was killed, brought to my place of work. So I never went back to work, and I was devastated. He was my only child. We were very close, and I didn't think it was possible to continue living, and I basically stayed in bed for many, many months. And when I came to, I remember they caught the person. He didn't know my son. There's no known reason why he fired the gun. And I remember I kept on asking the homicide detective, why was my son killed? Why? I needed some answers. And all he could tell me was he was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Which is such an unsatisfactory answer.
Right. And it became more and more so when I started seeing people killed in churches and in schools. And the more I thought of it, I thought, you know, my son had every right to go out and celebrate. I had no worries. He was grown. He was responsible. He had a bright future. So about a year after my son was killed, I started investigating, researching, and I guess I was pretty shocked to find out our country compared. I have relatives and friends who live in Europe and Australia, and just a shock to find out that how much more likely you're to die from a gun in this country and what our gun laws are like. And the more I investigated, the more I was amazed what I never knew. And I found, looking around online, I found the Everytown Survivor Network, which was just developing a few years after Moms. And it was organized around survivors with the thought that survivors have the moral authority to speak of gun violence because they're not statistics, they're the faces of gun violence.
Right, and they have names.
And they have names.
And stories.
And so I decided that that was how I was going to have to mother Camilo since he was no longer alive in my life. And that if I didn't speak up, who would I expect to speak up? Mm-hmm. So I started doing that full-time volunteering. So there's survivors across the country who are in the Survivor Network, from being spokespeople to telling their stories in their private life or in public life, just to put a face to this epidemic of gun violence that we all turn our heads to and say, oh, it can't happen to me.
Right.
So
That was your motivation. That's what kind of got you back in action and feeling like you were doing something to honor your son and honor the other survivors.
Correct.
Honor the other victims, I should say.
Right. And so now I know it's not, it feels like such a personal thing when something like this happens to you. And I started realizing the more people I would meet and the more stories I heard. And these are stories that aren't usually the mass shootings that we all hear about, the day-to-day shootings. I mean, that kind of is what my life is filled with now, and I hear, and it's just, you realize this is a problem in our society. It isn't just personal bad luck.
Right, and of course, your numbers are so much higher if you live in certain places or members of certain racial or ethnic groups, right? I mean, some of those numbers are just staggering,
right.
And we'll get to them.
And why this is Gun Violence Survivor Week, why the first week of February was named Gun Violence Survivor Week, is because in this country, by the first week of February, more people have died from a gun than die in our peer countries, other high-income countries that are not at war, in a whole year.
Yeah.
So that's the significance of it, and that's pretty eye-opening.
So, Liz, Russell, you and I are both very familiar with each other's stories, but I wonder if you could share it with the folks who are listening.
Sure. So I worked at the Pathway Home the morning of March 9th, 2018, a day that changed my life forever, changed Larry's life forever, I would argue. And changed, you know, my family and friends' lives forever. You know, I had made the decision to leave my position at the Pathway Home, and so March 9th was to be my last day. It was also my colleague Mackenzie's last day as well, and so there was a gathering planned for the both of us, a little party to send us off. That was attended by all staff members who were at the office that day, as well as the residents of the program who wished to attend. And so we gathered for that event around 10 a.m. that morning. You know, they were still putting up decorations and, you know, just trying to make it festive. So we probably started a few minutes late. And, you know, we all went in and we kind of did, you know, a little bit of housekeeping business related to things that were ongoing, just trying to tie up loose ends, you know. And Christine began, you know, thanking Mackenzie and I for the work that we had done over the last year that we had been there. And out of nowhere, in walked a person we all knew, strapped with an assault rifle and a shotgun and protective eye gear and protective ear covers, and just stood in the doorway, clearly blocking the doorway with what I would describe as sort of a calm intent. And I mean, I was certain in that moment that everybody in the room could see the internal shaking I felt. I felt that that was visible to everyone in the room. I couldn't look at the gunman. I froze, right? I mean, who would ever expect
you must
to
have
go
been
to work.
Total disbelief that this was actually happening before your eyes.
I was in extreme disbelief and shock, and just a million things were running through my mind. Like, am I about to die in this room with my coworkers? Am I never going to see my children again? I mean, things that you just should not have to encounter in your workplace. And Jen Gonzalez Shushiriba, who is a longtime family friend, was across the room from me, and I just stared at her. You know, she was the only one who said anything to the gunman while I was in the room. And, you know, she really went into clinician mode and, you know, said his name and said, "Stop, please don't do this." You know, and it just from one second to another, it was just, what is going to happen? What is going to happen? And the gunman ultimately let the residents in the program get up and leave. And then he called out staff member names. And one by one, we were allowed to leave. And I have to tell you, when he said my name, I just stared at my other colleagues who were still in the room, and to this day, it remains one of the most difficult things I've ever had to do, was get up and leave them in that room. Mm-hmm. It was extremely difficult. So we got out of the room and talked quickly amongst ourselves, for those of us who had been released, just trying to figure out what to do, how do we help them. I was encouraged to leave the program by your wife. She said, you have small children, you have to go. So I took off running down the stairs. And, you know, at this point, we just didn't know what was coming our way. Like, there was a vantage point from the window where you could see where we would exit, you know? Were we going to be watched as we were leaving? I mean, just right. There were so many things going through my head.
They didn't know if there were multiple gunmen. They didn't know if the building was booby-trapped.
We didn't know if we were safe.
Right.
And so, you know, from there we ran and were able to leave the campus and then spent an agonizing several hours waiting to hear the unimaginable.
Right.
That he would take their lives and his own.
Yeah. And it took just forever to confirm that, because the law enforcement was, I think, out of an abundance of caution, did not want to go rushing into that building. They weren't sure. I heard later that they had tried to establish kind of a video camera in a window to see, and there were drapes up. The walls in the pathway home, like so many old buildings up at the veterans home, are old and very thick, so they couldn't like put those mics up where they could hear through the wall. And so they heard the shots, but they just didn't know what they meant until much, much later. Meantime, you and my wife and others were on lockdown. And I always say, thank God your phones were working. Thank God for cell phones, because I at least was able to talk to her, you know, all day long until her phone battery ran out. So anyway, we could talk a lot about the pathway home. It's important, I think, to remember exactly what happened there, remember the names of the people, especially because they, like you, were doing important work to help vets who were suffering from PTSD and traumatic brain injury, a gift that many of them unfortunately come back with after they've, you know, done loyal service to our country. It's just incredibly important work. So, Ilana, let me ask you if you could tell us kind of your story and how you came to get involved with this organization as well.
Sure. So my story is very different from both Liz's and Claire's. When I was 17 years old, my 16-year-old cousin died by gun suicide. And, of course, it was incredibly devastating for my family. And I would say that to this day, it's just something that I don't think that my family will ever really recover from entirely. So I became involved with Moms Demand Action really about 2 years ago. And I think that this, you know, this thing that happened to us, to our family, was always sort of in the background, very much there, but I didn't really realize how much it was there until much later. And so I think what's interesting about survivors is that often you can be a survivor and not know necessarily that you're a survivor. So because, you know, my cousin was my cousin, not my son, I wasn't, you know, his parent, he wasn't my brother, I didn't know actually that I was a survivor for a long time until I came across Moms Demand Action and then the Survivor Network, and actually, you know, I discovered that I am a survivor. I also felt for a long time that that story wasn't necessarily mine to tell, because I wasn't, you know.
Yeah, I know how you feel. I know exactly how you feel.
So, but I think it's been really helpful to for me personally to be involved with Moms Demand Action, and for this part of why I became involved, I think it's just been helpful to be working with such, you know, great people like Liz and Claire and the Survivor Network and other volunteers from Moms Demand Action, which has helped me begin to tell my story. And also, I think it's just also healing. Mm-hmm. But I also just became involved with Moms Demand Action because I just felt more and more that I don't know. I get maybe it's my personality, but when things happen, I feel like it could be any of us, anywhere.
Right.
And so I think that was really what, for me, I just had to get involved.
What's interesting, since you were talking about suicide, I used to do some work with the American Psychiatric Association, and you know, I'm in the PR and media business, so I was working with the head of that organization just to prepare him for media interviews. And he is an expert in suicidal depression, and we got to talking about that. And the thing that so struck me was this idea that normally kind of mild-mannered, nonviolent people will take themselves out in such a violent way, like with a gun. And that it's important to remember that the person who is the victim of suicide is by far not the only victim of that suicide, right? Especially if it involves a violent act like a gun. So,
can I just say something I learned in being involved in this movement is that most people who attempt to end their life and don't succeed, never go on to attempt it again. For most people, not everyone, but for most people, it's an impulsive act. And if they use other means, they have a good chance of surviving that impulsive act. If they use a gun, they have little chance of surviving that. So that's why we include that in our in our organization as being part of gun violence.
My son had a job. Professionally, he was working on the Alameda County crisis line for a couple of years in the suicide hotline. And I learned so much from him, you know, about what people are calling for, what their state of mind is. And so often it's just to have somebody to talk to because they are really having second thoughts, but they're also feeling like they need to do it. Yeah, this whole area of suicidal depression is a really, really tough one.
Yeah, Larry, if I could just add, because one thing that's really great about Every Town and Moms Demand Action is that we're very data-driven. So to put numbers exactly to what you're saying, Claire, 85% of suicide attempts by gun result in death, while only 5% of suicide attempts by all other means result in death.
Including jumping off of buildings or you know, in front of traffic or trains or that sort of thing.
Yep.
Wow.
Exactly.
That's amazing. Well, I have diabolically now gotten you to do one of the first of the four things that your website says you should do, which is to share your stories. And we're going to take a short break now, come back and talk about education, the conversations that we need to be having, and how people can take action. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Larry Kamer. On today's program, we are talking about gun violence and how people in Napa and in other communities can honor the both the victims and survivors of gun violence during Gun Violence Survivors Week this week, which is the first week in February. My guests are Liz Russell, who is with Napa Valley Moms Demand Action. She is the Speak for Safety lead. Ilana Adelson, who is the co-lead of Moms Demand Action Napa Valley, and Claire Senchnia, did I get it right? Mm-hmm. Thank you. Because I was told you had a different name, so I'm just getting used to this. But you are the co-lead of the Everytown Survivor Network in California. Liz, before we went to break, we were talking about some of the cold realities of suicide and how much more likely one is to die if it's suicide by gun. There we go. And you have some experience and some observations on this, right?
Yeah. You know, for those that heard me share a bit about my survivor story at the Pathway Home, you know, it's a story of both gun homicide and gun suicide. You know, and just to sort of take you back to what that first year was like for me, you know, very much similar to what Claire shared in that, you know, your world is just shattered and you don't know what to do. I spent a lot of time in my room staring at the ceiling, just trying to make sense of my new reality. You know, I stopped taking my kids to school. You know, I couldn't bear conversations with people as simple as, hello, how are you doing? I did not have...
You didn't have a good answer for that question.
I didn't have an answer for that question. I mean, I literally couldn't think of what to say. Like a mere example, like talking to a store clerk, you know, checking out at the grocery store, and, you know, they ask everybody, how are you doing? And everyone, you know, usually just says, oh, I'm good. You know, that was not something that I could even do for months. So about 8 or so months went by, and that was around the time that we started getting information about the police report and things related to the incident at the Pathway Home, both the officer-involved shooting piece and then the full CHP report came out at the end of November. You know, and just sort of learning new details from those things, you know, just really sort of lit a fire, I think, inside of me, just to figure out, you know, what I could do. I finally reached the point of, I have to do something, you know, turn this anger and this pain into action. And it was around that time that I found out about California's gun violence restraining order law that had gone into effect in 2016. For those people who don't know what that is, you might also hear the term red flag law or extreme risk protection order. So those terms are used interchangeably. But California had a law on its books dating back to 2016. It was a result of the incident in 2014 in Isla Vista, the mass shooting that occurred there.
And UC Santa Barbara.
UC Santa Barbara. Yeah. You know, I found out that there was a mechanism for removing temporarily guns from somebody who is a danger to themselves or others. And, you know, it's a law intended to help people who are in crisis, to avert that crisis, and to temporarily remove firearms, which, as we know, we heard from Alana earlier, are the deadliest thing someone can use when they are suicidal.
One of the things that that the website urges people to do is to get educated. And one of the, I found a couple of really striking things looking through the site and doing some other research to prepare for the show today. The first is just how incredibly poorly researched gun violence really is. You know, dating back to a decision in 1996 that prevented scientists from the Centers for Disease Control from researching gun violence. Although the president, our current president, did allow in 2018 some gun violence research to be done so long as it doesn't promote gun control. After 31 people were killed in back-to-back mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton last August, the president blamed the shootings on, quote, gruesome video games and mentally ill monsters. But there's no scientific link between video games and shootings, or the irony on the mental health question is that people with mental health issues are much more likely to be victims of crime or victims of gun crimes. How do we make any progress if, even at the federal government, we are not honestly assessing the impact of gun deaths in the United States?
Well, first of all, I would like to point out that countries all over the world have people who suffer from mental illness and who watch video games and violent movies, and we're the only country that has such free access to guns, and the results are that we have more gun deaths in this country.
Because we have more guns. That the indicator is not video games. A lot of people play video games
right here
and around the world.
Yeah. But I again, to just give numbers, I think, to exactly what you're talking about, Claire, and you may have mentioned this at the beginning, but it's worth mentioning again, is that America's gun death rate is 10 times higher than other high-income countries, not at war, as you specified, Claire. And also, you know, the numbers really, you know, speak for themselves. I can't answer, you know, I'll let others also help answer the part about, you know, what do we do when not even the federal government is willing to kind of look this in the face. But, for example, you know, to just put more numbers to it, firearms are the second leading cause of death for children and teens in the United States, and the first leading cause of death for Black children and teens.
And these are incidents where there's a gun in the house, or the child can get access to the gun or play with the gun, or if the child's involved in some domestic dispute involving a gun.
I believe it's just that firearms are the second leading cause of death for children, period.
Amazing.
Whether it's whether it be, you know, suicide or whatever it may be, it's just that to me, that is just shocking and unacceptable.
So, go ahead.
But it's after Sandy Hook, Moms Demand Action started as a online Facebook group.
Right.
And then merged with Mayors Against Illegal Guns, became the Every Town Survivor Network. And now our numbers are millions in this country.
6 million.
Yeah.
6 million is part of Moms Demand.
Yeah. Yes. Led by moms. But
including
others.
Which is why people should fear you.
Yeah.
I've seen the video, and if you go to the website, whoever is doing some of the kind of promotional videos or the storytelling videos, they're very, very powerful.
And we're changing things. And it isn't at a federal, it's at a local and state by state basis. And we've had... You could just look at the 2018 elections, the elections that just happened in Virginia. Most people polled coming out said gun violence was one of their biggest reasons for voting for who they voted, and they voted for gun sense candidates. So it was the moms, along with other groups, of course, that have been around a long time, Brady and Giffords, a newer group. We all work in coalition. But we're making changes. We're going to have to keep on pushing. But,
and I would say there is nothing to fear in regards to, you know, moms aren't striking fear in the hearts of people.
I mean,
we are definitely
formidable. I mean that in a very friendly way.
It's a
very determined, savvy organization.
Formidable in our efforts to make all of our communities safer.
Yeah. I wanted to also talk about something that I know is of great concern to all of us, and that's school shootings. And what we can do and what your organization is involved with. Because, again, as with so many things, there are a lot of bad ideas and a lot of misinformation. You know, the idea that arming teachers is somehow going to make a school safer. Liz, you were talking a second ago about red flag laws. You know, Giffords says that is the number one thing we can do to prevent school shootings. What is your involvement in those issues or your organization's involvement?
So in California right now, Moms Demand Action is focused on just raising public awareness about the red flag law. I worked where I worked and did not know that there had been a law on the books for almost 2 years. You know, I'm not a clinician, so, you know, I was not privy to information regarding the residents in our program, right? Like, I wouldn't have known that someone was potentially a threat. But I think when those things are known and when people know that there are mechanisms to help those people, you know, that was the thing that got me, you know, out of bed and back into doing something. This was something tangible that me as a survivor of the incident that I went through could do. And
so can I ask you then, what should people know about the red flag laws if they are suspicious of somebody in their household or in their neighborhood or, you know, at work who may be about to do violence with a gun? What should they know, and where can they go for more information?
Sure. So I would say to start off, if you feel like someone is a danger to themselves or others, then you should contact law enforcement. There are different mechanisms that can be used depending on the situation. For the temporary removal of firearms and access to guns, gun permit and ammunition, like all those things are included in California's gun violence restraining order law. There's also domestic violence restraining orders, which is a whole different category. But first and foremost, to contact law enforcement.
So people should not hesitate to do that. I know sometimes
correct.
People think, well, I don't want to bother the cops. You know, maybe nothing's actually happening.
Right.
You're saying err on the side of letting them know.
I think err on the side of letting them know. Absolutely. I mean, if this is someone that is your family member or your friend or your roommate, those things are all covered under California's gun violence restraining order law, you can contact law enforcement and you can get assistance with filling out the petition to a judge to review and see if this person is potentially, yes, a danger to themselves or others.
So here in Napa, to the sheriff or Napa City Police or other local law enforcement, make the call if you're at all concerned. It's the old see something, say something kind of mentality, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, most school shootings have been shown that the perpetrators had made threats online.
That there were warning signs.
Yeah, there were big red flags. And
According to this info I got from Giffords, they say that the most important things that we can do to prevent school shootings are, one, pass red flag laws, and in your case, have people get to know about them and how they can utilize them. Encourage responsible firearm storage.
Absolutely.
The third is raise the age to purchase a semi-automatic firearm. Fourth is to require background checks on all gun sales. And fifth, create a threat assessment program in every school.
So H.R. 8 passed in Congress 8 months ago.
Almost a year.
Yeah, almost a year ago.
And tell us what that
does. And that covers the background checks on all gun sales. People think that that happens now. It does in California. It's state by state. But when the Brady Bill passed 25 years ago that required background checks, it was years before the internet came into being. So now many people buy guns off the internet without a background check. Also at gun sales, if you're a private seller in some states, you can buy without a background check. So that covers that, and it also covers red flag law. So that passed, a bipartisan passed in Congress, sent to the Senate, and it has sat on Mitch McConnell's desk, and they haven't taken it up.
If I can touch on the second item you mentioned, which is safe storage of firearms. Yeah. This is something that Moms Demand Action has been working on across the country. There's a program, another public awareness campaign that we run called Be Smart. And essentially the program is trying to teach people about how to ask about whether or not firearms are in the home, are present in the home of somewhere that your child might be going, and also talks about safe storage of those firearms and modeling appropriate behavior around firearms. So that's something else that Moms is working on and something we're doing here in our Napa Valley local group.
And people can learn more about this on the everytown.org site or go to the Giffords Law Center, which is also pretty a pretty impressive resource. I saw that in 2002, the Secret Service actually conducted a study showing that most people who had been shooters in mass shooting incidents had consumed very low quantities of violent media. That it is very easy to blame video games, the internet, and mental illness as a way of not really focusing on the real problem, right? Mm-hmm. And that when the president talks about, these mentally ill monsters who are doing these shootings, it really wastes such an opportunity, I think, to talk about what we can do to really begin to drive the numbers down. Do you agree?
Absolutely. I'll just go back to exactly what Claire explained, is that, other countries experience also, there's mental illness, there are violent video games and movies, but the numbers are just not the same as they are here in the United States. I could give you for days, but I'll just give you another one. Women in the United States are 16 times more likely to be killed with a gun than women in other high-income countries. If you want to look at that another way, the stat's a little bit old, but that means that, for example, in 2010, 90% of all women killed with guns in high-income countries were from the United States. So, these numbers just really paints the picture of the reality that, of the gun violence epidemic in the United States. The numbers just don't lie.
So here we are having a conversation, a very informed conversation, but How do you tell people to start these conversations in their everyday lives? You know, this is a topic that can be very divisive. People have very strong feelings about, but one of the things that every town encourages people to do is to start conversations. What does that mean?
Well, if there's any survivors listening, and we our definition of survivor is quite broad. If you've been someone you loved has died by a gun, by homicide, suicide, there's been an unintentional shooting, someone's been assaulted by a gun, who's witnessed, who've been passed part of a mass shooting, domestic violence shooting, it's very broad. You can get your cell phone right now and text HONOR, H-O-N-O-R, to 64433, and you'll be connected with our organization. You can also go online and look up Everytown Survivor Network to get more information. And we also have a digital advocacy site where you can put in your story or read other people's stories throughout the country. And it's called Moments That Survive/Everytown.
Would you give us that text information again?
You can text HONOR to 64433 if you are a survivor. If you want to get involved with Moms Demand Action, you can text also the same 64433.
Ready?
Yep.
And text READY.
Great. So lots of ways, lots of very easy ways to get connected into this network.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would also add, Larry, that I think the work of the Survivor Network is so important, because I think it's possible for people to feel that, for maybe not know that they're survivors, or to sort of feel like gun violence has not affected me and it probably won't. But when you start to peel away the layers, you actually begin to see just how many people are affected by gun violence,
that
right?
It's not actually literally you being shot,
exactly,
necessarily.
Right. Or even, necessarily, your immediate child. In my case, it was my cousin.
Right.
And so when you start to sort of have these conversations and you start to, engage with survivors, you begin to realize just how many of us there are.
Can you talk a little bit more about that, about the kind of therapeutic effects, or because it sounds like all of you kind of got out of, a very depressed state, an understandably depressed state, and began getting more involved. What does that do for you, just kind of from a mental health perspective, or from kind of your desire to kind of get back and contribute again?
I will just quickly say that I think for a topic or a subject that you can quickly so much feel that you don't have any control and that there's nothing you can do, for me, it has been so therapeutic and helpful and productive to just take action and to begin to do something. And it's amidst all the turmoil that we can have around us, it's what really keeps me feeling like I can exert some control over the situation, and it's what keeps me going.
So the last thing that the Everytown website says about the best ways in which we can honor gun violence survivors is called take action. So we have just a couple of minutes left, but let's talk about what people can do, whether they are just interested in this topic, whether they're survivors or have victims in their families, or come at this issue from another way. What do you tell them they should be doing? What are the ways they can actually take action? We have the text information, which is a good way to start. What else?
I think if you get plugged into your local Moms Demand Action group, maybe attend a new member coffee, or maybe attend one of a regular member meeting. Take a look at the events that they have coming up. We actually have a couple of events coming up here in Napa Valley. The first is an event at Hall Winery on Sunday, March 29th. Mm-hmm. Tickets are available for that. It's going to benefit the work of Moms Demand Action. Shannon Watts, the founder of Moms Demand Action, will be speaking, as well as our local Congressman Thompson, who we all know to be a gun sense champion. And then one thing that Napa Valley did in the aftermath of the what felt like back-to-back, the Parkland shooting in Florida happened on February 14th, 2018, and then the shooting at the Pathway Home was just 2 to 3 weeks later on March 9th, 2018. where a group of individuals got together and formed Rock the Ride, which will be coming back for its third year this year.
And that is what? What's Rock the Ride?
It is essentially our community using its voices and its feet to talk about the statistics around gun violence in America, you know, putting face and numbers to this epidemic in our country.
So it's an event anybody can participate.
It's an event anyone can
ride your bike. You can
ride, You can walk. Right. You can just come for brunch.
That's kind of more my speed, yeah.
And that takes place on the last Saturday in June this year. It is the
27th.
What else? What else comes to mind when somebody listening to this says, all right, you've convinced me. What should I do? What can I do?
There's so here in our California State Chapter of Moms Demand Action, we have a fantastic event coming up, which is called Advocacy Day, which is where when we go to the state capitol in Sacramento as Moms Demand Action, the whole state. So there's more than 400 of us. And we're there to have pre-scheduled meetings with our legislators, and we're essentially we're there to advocate for our the legislation we're focusing on in the state that year, which is of course gun sense legislation always.
Having worked in Sacramento and worked as a lobbyist in the legislature, I can tell you and tell people those things really matter. When 400 people, you know, take their own time to come and talk about an issue that they have no vested economic interest in, they're not being paid to be there, it really does make a difference. So I would echo that. It is something that for legislative staffers and for members of the legislature, it really does matter.
I would say that too. If, you know, taking a day off work or finding childcare feel like things that are stopping you from being involved in an in-person action, there are lots of other ways that you can be involved. You can contact your representatives by phone and by email to let them know that you care about this issue. If they're a gun sense candidate, you know, it never hurts to call up their office and say, you know, I support their stance and I appreciate what they're doing and I will keep voting for them. So there's lots of different ways.
So even a call to Mike Thompson's office matters.
Absolutely.
Even though you know where he stands and even though he has done the right thing on this issue, they do need to hear from us that we support them.
Correct.
We call our senators, even though we know where they stand on these issues, we call them a lot. I would also say that what's great about Moms Demand Action, to anybody who may be listening, if you're in the Napa area or not, is that Moms Demand Action has a lot of actions that you can take that are even from, you know, the comfort of your home. So it may be you could do phone banking, you can do text banking. There's just a lot of ways to concretely get involved and take action.
And
there's something for everyone.
And it doesn't necessarily mean writing a check. You can use sweat equity. You can volunteer your time. You can contribute your ideas.
You might have 1 hour a month, and in that hour, you do text banking. That's really powerful.
So again, this week, February 1st to the 8th, is National Gun Violence Survivors Week. I want to thank my guests today, Liz Russell, who is the 2020 Everytown Survivor Fellow and the Napa Valley Moms Demand Action Speak for Safety Lead, Ilana Adelson, the co-lead of the Napa Valley Moms Demand Action, and Claire Sechnia, the California co-lead of the Everytown Survivors Network. Thank you all very much for coming on today and helping us understand this issue a little bit better.
Thanks.
We're going to wrap it up. So, as I say, if you have ideas for future programs or guests, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at deepdiveshow@winddownmedia.com, on Twitter and Instagram at deepdiveshow. And as I say, please like us on Facebook. It really does make a difference. As always, I appreciate the help I get from Antonio DeWalk and my friends here at KVON. I want to thank you very much for joining us on The Deep Dive. I'm Larry Kamer, and we'll see you next time.